Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? The rules of this briefing are very simple. In about 60 seconds, we will give you the announcement that you have all been waiting for. The names of the 7 volunteers who will become the Mercury Astronaut Team. Following the distribution of the kit, and this will be done as speedily as possible. Those of you who have PM deadline problems had better dash for your phones. We will have about a 10 or 12 minute break during which the gentlemen will be available for picture taking. Some men from over on the sides appeared and began handing out folders, and people were rushing up and grabbing these kits and bolting from the room. Bonnie pointed to the 7 of them sitting there at the table and said, "Gentlemen, these are the astronaut volunteers. Take your pictures as you will, gentlemen." And now began a very odd business. Without another word, all these grim little crawling beggar figures began advancing toward them, elbowing and hipping one another out of the way, growling and muttering, but never looking at each other, since they had their cameras screwed into their eye sockets and remained concentrated on Gus and the 6 other pilots at the table in the most obsessive way. Like a swarm of root weevils, which, no matter how much energy they might expend in all directions trying to muscle one another out of the way, keep their craving beaks homed in on the juicy stuff that the whole swarm has sensed, until they were all over them, within inches of their faces in some cases, poking their mechanical beaks into everything but their belly buttons. Yet this, by itself, was not what made the moment so strange. It was something else on top of it. There was such frantic excitement, and their names had not even been mentioned. Yet it didn't matter in the slightest. They didn't care whether he was Gus Grissom or Joe Blow. They were ravenous for his picture all the same. They were crawling all over him and the other 6 as if they were creatures of tremendous value and excitement. Real prizes. Ravenous they were. These swarming photographers who could grunt but not speak, who crawled over them for a full 15 minutes. Nevertheless, who was dying for the press conference to start? Any time Gus had to tell total strangers how he felt about anything, it made him uncomfortable. And the thought of doing it so publicly, in this room, in front of several hundred people, made him extremely uncomfortable. Gus came from the sort of background where, to put it mildly, glibness was not encouraged. Back in Mitchell, Indiana, his father had been a railroad worker. His mother used to take the family to the Church of Christ, a Protestant denomination that was so fundamentalist no musical instruments were allowed in the church, not even a piano. The human voice raising, thanks to God, was music enough. Not that Gus was much of a singer either, however. His public incantations consisted mainly of Hoosier Gus gruffisms. He was a short man with sloping shoulders, a compact build, black crew-cut hair, and black bushy eyebrows, a broad nose, and a face given to very dour looks. The only time Gus felt like talking was when he was with other pilots, particularly at beer call. Then he became another human being. His sleepy eyes lit up to about 200 watts. A crazy, confident grin took over his mouth. He would start talking a streak and drinking a lake and, when the midnight madness struck, getting into his hot rod and sucking the surrounding countryside up his 2 exhaust pipes. Flying and drinking and drinking and driving, of course. Gus was one of those young men, quite common in the United States, actually, who would fight you down to the last unbroken bone over an insult to the gray little town they came from, or the grim little church they fidgeted in all those years, while at the same time, in some hidden corner of the soul, they prostrated themselves daily in thanksgiving to the things that had gotten them the hell out of there. In Gus's case, those things had been hot rods and now airplanes. Gus had flown 100 missions in combat in Korea and had won the Distinguished Flying Cross, after breaking formation to chase away a MiG-15 that was about to jump one of his outfit's reconnaissance planes. Although somehow, during that great duck shoot over Korea, to his regret, he had never succeeded in downing an enemy plane. After the war, he had done all-weather testing of fighter planes at Wright-Patterson and was highly thought of there. So far, he had not reached the big league, which was being prime pilot for testing a new fighter, preferably at Edwards. But Gus had every confidence in himself, which is to say, he was a typical fighter jock heading up the pyramid. He also sensed that winning out in the competition for Project Mercury was a tremendous achievement for him, even if it remained to be seen just how far this advanced a man up the ziggurat. There was just one odd thing about the situation. Last night at Langley Field near Newport News, Virginia, Gus had met the six other pilots who had won out. Two of the Air Force pilots were from Edwards. That was to be expected. Edwards was the big league. But one of them, Gordon Cooper, was a man Gus had known at Wright Pat at one point, and Cooper was not in fighter ops at Edwards. The very hottest pilots at Edwards, of course, were in the rocket plane projects, the X series. The best line test pilots were in fighter ops as prime pilots in the testing of aircraft, such as the Century series of jet fighters. That was what the other Edwards pilot, Deke Slayton, had been involved in. But Cooper had graduated from test pilot school and was officially a test pilot, but he had been involved mainly in engineering. Not only that, there was this fellow from the Navy, Scott Carpenter. He seemed to be a likable sort, but he had never been in a fighter squadron. He had been flying multi-engine propeller planes and had only 200 hours in jets. What did this say about the business of being selected as a Mercury astronaut? Finally, the NASA people were shooing the photographers away from the table, and the head of NASA, a man with big smooth jowls named T. Keith Glennon, got up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, today we are introducing you and to the world these seven men who have been selected to begin training for orbital space flight. These men, the nation's Project Mercury astronauts, are here after a long and perhaps unprecedented series of evaluations, which told our medical consultants and scientists of their superb adaptability to their upcoming flight." And it was probably noticed by no one other than the seven pilots themselves that he mentioned only their adaptability. He had nothing to say, not a word, about their prowess or standing as pilots. "It is my pleasure," said Glennon, "to introduce to you, and I consider it a very real honor, gentlemen, Malcolm S. Carpenter, Leroy G. Cooper, John H. Glenn Jr., Virgil I. Grissom, Walter M. Sherratt Jr., Alan B. Shepard Jr., and Donald K. Slayton, the nation's Mercury astronauts." With that, applause erupted. Applause of the most fervent sort. Amazing applause. Reporters rose to their feet, applauding as if they had come for no other reason. Smiles of weepy and grateful sympathy washed across their faces. They gulped. They cheered as if this was one of the most inspiring moments of their lives. Even some of the photographers straightened up out of their beggar's crouches and let their cameras dangle from their straps so that they could use their hands for clapping. But for what? Once the reporters and photographers got a hold of themselves again, men from NASA, the Air Force, and the Navy got up and testified how terrifically the seven of them had done on all the tests at Lovelace and Wright-Patterson, yet not one word was uttered about any ability or experience they might have as pilots. The tone of the thing, the angle, didn't improve with the questions from the reporters. The first reporter who raised his hand wanted to know from each of them whether his wife and children had had anything to say about this. Wife and children? Most of them, Gus included, dealt with this question in typical military pilot fashion, which is to say, they managed to get out something brief, obvious, abstract, and above all, safe and impersonal. But when it becomes the turn of the guy sitting on Gus's left, John Glenn, the only Marine in the group, it's hard to believe. This guy starts turning on the charm. He has a regular little speech on the subject. "I don't think any of us would really go on with something like this," he says, "if We didn't have a pretty good backing at home, really. My wife's attitude toward this has been the same as it has been all along through my flying. If it is what I want to do, she is behind it. And the kids are too, 100%. What the hell was he talking about? I don't think any of us could really go on with something like this. What possible difference could a wife's attitude make about an opportunity for a giant step up the great ziggurat? What was with this guy? It kept on in that fashion. Some reporter gets up and asks them all to tell about their religious affiliations. Religious affiliations. And Glenn tees off again. I'm a Presbyterian, he says. A Protestant Presbyterian, and I take my religion very seriously, as a matter of fact. He starts telling them about all the Sunday schools he has taught at, and the church boards he has served on, and all the church work that he and his wife and his children have done. I was brought up believing that you are placed on earth here more or less with sort of a 50-50 proposition. And this is what I still believe. We are placed here with certain talents and capabilities. It is up to each of us to use those talents and capabilities as best you can. If you do that, I think there is a power greater than any of us that will place the opportunities in our way. And if we use our talents properly, we will be living the kind of life we should live. Jesus Christ, share it, brother! You can see the boys cutting glances from either end of the table up at this flying churchman Gus is sitting next to. They're seated in alphabetical order, with Scott Carpenter at one end and Deke Slayton at the other and Glenn in the middle. What can anybody say as the follow-up to this man and his speeches about the wife and the children and the family and Sunday school and God? What can you do? Say that, as a matter of fact, you can get along just as well without any of them as long as they'll let you fly? That didn't seem very prudent. Turn on the halo and lie. You can see these pilots struggling to put up enough chips to stay in the God and family game with this pious Marine named Glenn. When it was Gus's turn, he said, I consider myself religious. I'm a Protestant and belong to the Church of Christ. I'm not real active in church as Mr. Glenn is. Mr. Glenn, he calls him. But I consider myself a good Christian still. Deke Slayton says, as far as my religious faith is concerned, I am a Lutheran, and I go to church periodically. One of the Navy pilots, Alan Shepard, says, I am not a member of any church. I attend the Christian Science Church regularly. And so it went. It was a struggle. God, family, the only thing that Glenn hadn't wrapped them all up in was country. And so he took care of that, too. He gave a nice little speech that started with Orville and Wilbur Wright standing on a hill at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, tossing a coin to see which one would take the first airplane flight. And then he tied that in with the first space flight. I think we are very fortunate, he said, that we have, should we say, been blessed with the talents that have been picked for something like this. No one had said a word about talents, however. I think that we would be remiss in our duty, he went on, if we didn't make the fullest use of our talents in volunteering for something that is as important as this is to our country and to the world in general right now. This could mean an awful lot to this country, of course. Guy had the halo turned on at all times. Glenn had all the verbal skills that Gus lacked, and yet he didn't seem glib or smooth about it. He looked like a balding and slightly tougher version of the cutest-looking freckle-faced country boy you ever saw. He had a snub nose, light hazel eyes, reddish-blonde hair, a terrific smile, and thousands of freckles. He had the sunniest face in 10 counties. He was also one of the best-known pilots in the Marines. He had flown in combat in both the Second World War and the Korean War, and had won many medals, including 5 DFCs, and 2 years ago, in 1957, he had made the first coast-to-coast nonstop supersonic flight. On the basis of that accomplishment, he had been invited onto a TV show, Name That Tune, with a child singer, Eddie Hodges as his partner, and he had beamed the freckled smile on TV and just charmed the hell out of everybody. The two of them were on the show several weeks. Well, hell, maybe he was sincere, after all. God knew that for any pilot to get involved in that much Sunday school and not many church boards and good works, he'd have to be a true believer and a half. Perhaps he even meant it about wife and family, which would make him an even rarer breed of fighter pilot. If anybody asked Gus, like right now, if he were a religious, family man, and a patriot, he would say yes, he was religious, and yes, he was a family man, and yes, he was a patriot. But the firmest conviction of the three was about being a patriot. When Gus said he would gladly ride a Mercury rocket for the sake of his country, he meant it. Alan Shepard said the same thing, and there was not the slightest doubt that he meant it. And there was no doubt that Glenn meant it, no matter how he went on about it. That was one of the inexpressible things about being a military flying officer. You meant it. You were among the few who had the uncritical willingness to face danger. There was an exhilaration to this that few civilians could possibly comprehend. No, Gus was a patriot. And he had his 100 combat missions and his DFC to attest to that simple, beautiful fact. Now, as for being a family man, oh, hell. He meant to be a family man, but somehow his career or something always got in the way. He and his wife, Betty, had gotten married as soon as they finished high school in Mitchell. Right from the very first, he found himself in situations where he became separated from her. He didn't plan it that way, but it kept happening. Right after they got married, he was due to start his freshman year at Purdue, and so he went off to Purdue to find some place for them to live. Well, somehow the only place he could find was a basement room. She said that was okay, she didn't mind. They'd live in a basement room. He said, well, the problem was he was going to have to share the room with another guy. It was the only way he could afford it. So he would get back to Mitchell as often as he could on weekends. So that was the way they started out, with him on the campus at Purdue and Betty living with her parents in Mitchell. Military flying was hard on home life, too. Gus graduated and started his Air Force training at Randolph Field in Texas. Betty was pregnant, and he was in training, and was making only $100 a month anyway, and so why didn't she stay in Seymour, Indiana, with her sister Mary Lou, and Gus would visit her when he could? The only trouble was he couldn't visit her very often, it being so expensive to travel from Texas to Indiana. When Betty gave birth to their first child, Scott, Gus was at an important part in his flight training and couldn't get to Indiana for that either. He gets on the phone and says to her, well, you tell me what you really want me to do. And she says, well, I guess you ought not to interrupt your training. In fact, he didn't quite manage to see his first child until 6 months later. Now, that sort of thing could happen in the service because a fellow could get sent overseas at a moment's notice, but he, Gus, hadn't been sent anywhere except down the road to Arizona, to Williams Air Force Base for advanced training. At the time, well, it just seemed damned hard to get all the way from the southwestern USA to Indiana when you were in the thick of flight training. Then the Air Force did send him overseas to Korea, and Betty went back to Indiana again. Korea. He loved it. He liked combat missions so much that when he completed 100 missions, he volunteered for 25 more. He wanted to stay there. But the bastards made him come back. Somehow, he and Betty managed to get by through all this. He gruffed a lot of Hoosier Gus gruffisms at her, and she gruffed some back. They didn't get in many fights. Most weekends, he could manage it. He would fly cross-country, piling up flight time. But how different was he from the other pilots at this table, if the truth were known? Except for this unbelievable Marine, Glenn, who was sitting up here next to him painting some goddamn amazing picture of the perfect pilot, wrapped up in a cocoon of home and hearth and God and flag. Neither he nor any of the others set about altering that picture, however. At first, it was hard to figure out what was happening. Glenn could have never gone off on these fantastic outside loops of his if it were not for the fact that practically every question had to do with families and faith and motivation and patriotism and so on. There had not been a single question about their achievements or experience as pilots. Then one of the reporters gets up and says, "Could I ask for a show of hands of how many are confident that they will come back from outer space?" Gus and the others started looking down the table at each other, and then they all started hoisting their hands in the air. It really made you feel like an idiot raising your hand this way. If you didn't think you were coming back, then you would really have to be a fool or a nut to have volunteered at all. As the seven of them looked at each other sitting there with their hands up in the air like school children, they began grinning in embarrassment, and then the heart of the matter dawned on them. This question about coming back was nothing other than a euphemistic way of asking, "Aren't you afraid you're going to die?" That was the question these people had been circling around the whole time. That was what they really wanted to know, all these wide-eyed reporters and their grunting, crawling beggar photographers. They didn't care whether the seven Mercury astronauts were pilots or not. Infantrymen or acrobats would have done just as well. The main thing was they had volunteered to sit on top of the rockets, which always blew up. They were brave lads who had volunteered for a suicide mission. They were kamikazes going forth to vie with the Russians, and all the questions about wives and children and faith and God and motivation and the flag, they were really questions about widows and orphans, and how a warrior talks himself into going on a mission in which he is bound to die. And this man, John Glenn, had given them an answer as sentimental as the question itself, and Gus and the rest had gone along with it. Henceforth, they would be served up inside the biggest slice of mom's pie you can imagine, and it all happened in just about an hour. The seven of them sat there like fools with their hands hung up in the air, grinning with embarrassment, but that was all right. They would get over the embarrassment soon enough. Glenn, one couldn't help noticing, had both hands up in the air. By the next morning, the seven Mercury astronauts were national heroes. It happened just like that, even though so far they had done nothing more than show up for a press conference. They were known as the seven bravest men in America. They woke up to find astonishing acclaim all over the press. There it was in the more sophisticated columns as well as in the tabloids and on television. Even James Reston of the New York Times had been so profoundly moved by the press conference and the sight of the seven brave men that his heart, he confessed, now beat a little faster. "What made them so exciting," he wrote, "was not that they said anything new, but that they said all the old things with such fierce convictions. They spoke of duty and faith and country like Walt Whitman's pioneers." This is a pretty cynical town, but nobody went away from these young men scoffing at their courage and idealism. Manly courage, the right stuff, the halo effect, with John Glenn leading the hallelujah chorus, had practically wiped the man out. If Gus and some of the others had been worried that they weren't being regarded as hot pilots, their worries were over when they saw the press coverage. Without exception, the newspapers and wire services picked out the highlights of their careers and carefully masked them to create a single blaze of glory. This took true journalistic skill. It meant citing a great deal from John Glenn's career, his combat flying in two wars, his five distinguished flying crosses with 18 clusters, and his recent speed record, plus the combat that Gus and Wally Schirra had seen in Korea and the medals they had won. One DFC apiece, and the bombing missions Slayton had flown in the Second World War, and a bit about the jet fighters he had helped test at Edwards and the ones Shepard had tested at Pax River, and going easy on the subject of Scott Carpenter and Gordon Cooper, who had not flown in combat, Shepard had not either, or done any extraordinary testing. John Glenn came out of it tops among seven very fair-haired boys. He had the hottest record as a pilot. He was the most quotable, the most photogenic, and the lone Marine. but all seven, collectively, emerged in a golden haze as the seven finest pilots and bravest men in the United States. A blazing aura was upon them all. It was as if the press in America, for all its vaunted independence, was a great colonial animal, an animal made up of countless clustered organisms responding to a single nervous system. In the late 1950s, as in the late 1970s, the animal seemed determined that in all matters of national importance, the proper emotion, the seemly sentiment, the fitting moral tone should be established and should prevail. And all information that muddied the tone and weakened the feeling should simply be thrown down the memory hole. In a later period, this impulse of the animal would take the form of blazing indignation about corruption, abuses of power, and even minor ethical lapses among public officials. Here, in April of 1959, it took the form of a blazing patriotic passion for the seven test pilots who had volunteered to go into space. In either case, the animal's fundamental concern remained the same. The public, the populace, the citizenry must be provided with the correct feelings. One might regard this animal as the consummate hypocritical Victorian gent. Sentiments that one scarcely gives a second thought to in one's private life are nevertheless insisted upon in all public utterances. And this grave gent lives on in excellent health. Even so, why was the press aroused to create instant heroes out of these seven men? This was a question that not James Reston or the pilots themselves or anyone at NASA could have answered at the time, because the very language of the proposition had long since been abandoned and forgotten. The forgotten term left behind in the superstitious past was single combat. Just as the Soviet success in putting Sputniks into orbit around the Earth revived long-buried superstitions about the power of heavenly bodies and the fear of hostile control of the heavens, so did the creation of astronauts and a manned space program bring back to life one of the ancient superstitions of warfare. Single combat had been common throughout the world in the pre-Christian era and endured in some places through the Middle Ages. In single combat, the mightiest soldier of one army would fight the mightiest soldier of the other army as a substitute for a pitched battle between the entire forces. In some cases, the combat would pit small teams of warriors against one another. Single combat was not seen as a humanitarian substitute for wholesale slaughter until late in its history. That was a Christian reinterpretation of the practice. Originally, it had a magical meaning. In ancient China, first the champion warriors would fight to the death as a testing of fate, and then the entire armies would fight, emboldened or demoralized by the outcome of the single combat. Before Muhammad's first battle as the warrior prophet, the Battle of Badr, three of Muhammad's men challenged the Meccans to pick out any three of their soldiers to fight in single combat, proceeded to destroy them with all due ceremony, whereupon Muhammad's entire force routed the entire Meccan force. In other cases, however, the single combat settled the affair and there was no full-scale battle, as when the Vandal and the Alaman armies confronted each other in Spain in the 5th century AD. They believed that the gods determined the outcome of single combat. Therefore, it was useless for the losing side to engage in full-scale combat. The Old Testament story of David and Goliath is precisely that, a story of single combat that demoralizes the losing side. The gigantic Goliath, with his brass helmet, coat of mail, and ornate greaves, is described as the Philistine champion who comes forth to challenge the Israelites to send forth a man to fight him. The proposition being that whoever loses, his people will become slaves of the other side. Before going out to meet Goliath, David, an unknown volunteer commoner, is given King Saul's own decorative armor, although he declines to wear it. When he kills Goliath, the Philistines regard this as such a terrible sign that they flee and are pursued and slaughtered. Naturally, the brave lads chosen for single combat enjoyed a very special status in the army and among their people. David was installed in the royal household and eventually superseded Saul's own sons and became king. They were revered and extolled. Songs and poems were written about them, and every reasonable effort and honor was given to them. And women and children and even grown men were moved to tears in their presence. Part of this outpouring of emotion and attention was the simple response of a grateful people to men who were willing to risk their lives to protect them. But there was also a certain calculation behind it. The steady pressure of fame and honor tended to embolden the lads still further by constantly reminding them that the fate of the entire people was involved in their performance in battle. At the same time, and this was no small thing in such a high-risk occupation, the honor and glory were in most cases rewards before the fact, on account, as it were. Archaic cultures were quite willing to elevate their single combat fighters to heroic status even before their blood was let, because it was such an effective incentive. Any young man who entered the Corps would get his rewards here on Earth up front, to use the current phrase, come what may. With the decline of archaic magic, the belief in single combat began to die out. The development of the modern, highly organized army and the concept of total war seemed to bury it forever. But then an extraordinary thing happened. The atomic bomb was invented. And the result was that the concept of total war was nullified. The incalculable power of the A-bomb and the bombs that followed also encouraged the growth of a new form of superstition founded upon awe not of nature, as archaic magic had been, but of technology. During the Cold War period, small-scale competitions once again took on the magical aura of a testing of fate, of a fateful prediction of what would inevitably happen if total nuclear war did take place. This, of course, was precisely the impact of Sputnik 1, launched around the Earth by the Soviets' mighty and mysterious Integral in October of 1957. The space race became a fateful test and presage of the entire Cold War conflict between the superpowers, the Soviet Union, and the United States. Surveys showed that people throughout the world looked upon the competition in launching space vehicles in that fashion, i.e., as a preliminary contest proving final and irresistible power to destroy. The ability to launch Sputniks dramatized the ability to launch nuclear warheads on ICBMs. But in these neo-superstitious times, it came to dramatize much more than that. It dramatized the entire technological and intellectual capability of the two nations and the strength of the national wills and spirits. Hence, John McCormick's rising in the House of Representatives to say that the United States faced national extinction if she did not overtake the Soviet Union in the space race. The next great achievement would be the successful launching of the first man into space. In the United States, no one could say what was taking place in the land of the mighty Integral. The men chosen for this historic mission took on the archaic mantles of the single combat warriors of a long since forgotten time. They would not be going into space to do actual combat, or not immediately, although it was assumed that something of the sort might take place in a few years. But they were entering into a deadly duel in the heavens in any event. Our rockets always blow up. The space war was on. They were risking their lives for their country, for their people, in the fateful testing versus the powerful Soviet Integral. And even though the archaic term itself had disappeared from memory, they would receive all the homage, all the fame, all the honor and heroic status before the fact of the single combat warrior. Thus beat the mighty drum of martial superstition in the mid-20th century. It was glorious. It was crazy. The following month, May, the House Committee on Science and Astronautics, of which McCormick was a member, called the seven astronauts before them in closed session. So the brave lads went to the Capitol for the secret proceedings. It was a strange and marvelous time. It became immediately apparent that, from the committee chairman, Representative Overton Brooks, on down, no one had anything pertinent to ask them and nothing to tell them. The congressman kept saying things like, "As you men know, you are an outstanding group in our country and in our country's history." Or they would ask them questions that elicited choral responses, Brooks himself said, "All of you gentlemen have been in this type of work, that is, handling experimental airplanes, in the past, haven't you? You know what it is. You know that in handling any new experimental flying machine, there is a certain type of risk. You understand that. Isn't that right?" Then he peered beseechingly at the seven of them until they began chiming in all at once. "Yes, sir. Right, sir. Certainly, sir. That's correct, sir." There was something gloriously goofy about it. The congressmen in the room just wanted to see them, to use their position to arrange a personal audience, to gaze upon them with their own eyes across the committee table, no more than 4 feet away, to shake hands with them, occupy the same space on this earth with them for an hour or so, fawn over them, pay homage to them, bathe in their magical aura, feel the radiation of their righteous stuff, salute them, wish upon them the smile of God, and do their bit in bestowing honor upon them before the fact. Upon our little Davids, before they got up on top of the rockets to face the Russians, death, flames, and fragmentation. Ours all blow up. Chuck Yeager was in Phoenix to make one of his many public appearances on behalf of the Air Force. By now, the Air Force couldn't publicize Yeager, breaker of the sound barrier, enough. Like the other branches of the service, the Air Force now saw that there was nothing like heroes and record holders for getting good press and winning appropriations. The only problem was that, in terms of publicity, every other form of flyer was now overshadowed by the Mercury astronauts. As a matter of fact, today in Phoenix, what was it the local reporters wanted to ask Chuck Yeager about? Correct. The astronauts. One of them got the bright idea of asking Yeager if he had any regrets about not being selected as an astronaut. Yeager smiled and said, "Nope, they gave me the opportunity of a lifetime to fly the X-1 and the X-1A, and that's more than a man could ask for right there. They gave this new opportunity to some new fellas coming along, and that's what they ought to do. Besides," he added, "I've been a pilot all my life, and there won't be any flying to do in Project Mercury." No flying. That was all it took. The reporters looked stunned. In some way, they couldn't comprehend immediately. Yeager was casting doubt on two undisputable facts. One, that the seven Mercury astronauts were chosen because they were the seven finest pilots in America, and two, that they would be pilots on the most daring flights in American history. "The thing was," he said, "the Mercury system was completely automated. Once they put you in the capsule, that was the last you got to say about the subject."
"What?"
"Well," said Yeager, "a monkey is going to make the first flight."
"A monkey?"
The reporters were shocked. It happened to be true that the plans called for sending up chimpanzees in both suborbital and orbital flights, identical to the flights the astronauts would make before risking the men. But to just say it like that, was this national heresy? What the hell was it? Fortunately for Yeager, the story didn't blow up into anything. The press, the eternal Victorian gent, just couldn't deal with what he had said. The wire services wouldn't touch that remark. It ran in one of the local newspapers, and that was that. But for Christ's sake, Yeager was only saying what was obvious to all the rocket pilots who had flown at Edwards. Here was everybody talking as if the Mercury astronauts would be the first men to ride rockets. Yeager had done precisely that more than 40 times. 15 other pilots had done it also, and they had reached speeds greater than 3 times the speed of sound and an altitude of 126,000 feet, nearly 25 miles, and that was just the beginning. This very next month, June 1959, Scott Crossfield would begin the first testing of the X-15, designed for a pilot, not a passenger, to take up to more than 50 miles into space at speeds approaching Mach 7. All of this should have been absolutely obvious to anyone, even people who knew nothing about flying. And surely it would become clear that anybody in Project Mercury was more of a test subject than a pilot. Two of the people they chose weren't even in fighter ops. They had one excellent test pilot from Edwards, Deke Slayton, But he had never been high on the list of those considered for something like the X-Series. The other Air Force pilot, Grissom, was assigned to Wright Pat and was doing more secondary testing than prime work. Two of the Navy guys, Shepard and Shirah, were good experienced test pilots, solid men, even though neither had done anything to make anybody's mouth fall open at Edwards. Glenn had made a name for himself by setting the speed record in the F-8U, but he had not done much major flight test work, at least not by Edwards standards. Well, hell, what did anybody expect? Naturally, they hadn't picked the seven hottest pilots they could find. They wouldn't be doing any flying. Surely all this would become obvious in time, and yet it wasn't becoming obvious. Here at mighty Edwards itself, the boys could feel the earth trembling. A great sliding of the templates was taking place inside the invisible pyramid. You could feel the old terrain crumbling, and seven rookies were somehow being installed as the hottest numbers in flying. And they hadn't done a goddamn thing yet but turn up at a press conference. Chapter 6. On the Balcony. From the very beginning, this astronaut business was just an unbelievable good deal. It was such a good deal that it seemed like tempting fate for an astronaut to call himself an astronaut, even though that was the official job description. You didn't even refer to the others as astronauts. You'd never say something such as, "I'll take that up with the other astronauts." You'd say, "I'll take that up with the other fellas or the other pilots." Somehow calling yourself an astronaut was like a combat ace going around describing his occupation as combat ace. This thing was such an unbelievable good deal. It was as if astronaut were an honorific like champion or superstar, as if the word itself were one of the infinite variety of goodies that Project Mercury was bringing your way. And not just goodies in the crass sense, either. It had all the things that made you feel good, including the things that were good for the soul. For long stretches, you'd bury yourself in training, in blissful isolation, good, rugged, bare-boned isolation, in low-rent surroundings, in settings that even resembled hallowed Edwards in the old X-1 days, and with that same pioneer spirit which money cannot buy, and with everybody pitching in and working endless hours so that rank meant nothing, and people didn't even have the inclination, much less the time, to sit around and make the usual complaints about government work. And then, just about the same time you were entering a good, healthy state of exhaustion from the work, they would take you out of your isolation and lead you up to that balcony that all fighter jocks secretly dreamed of, the one where you walked out before the multitudes like the Pope, and it actually happened. The people of America cheered their brains out for 30 minutes or so, and then you went back into your noble isolation for more work, or for a few proficiency runs at nailing down the holy coordinates of the fighter jock's life, which were, of course, flying and drinking and driving, and the rest of it. The things you could plot on the great graph of Project Mercury in the most spectacular way, with the exception of the first, flying. The lack of flying time was troubling, but the other items existed in such extraordinary dimensions that it was hard to concentrate on it at first. Any man who wasn't above a little regrouping now and then to keep the highly trained mechanism from being wound up too tight, to maintain an even strain, in the Shirah parlance, found himself in absolute fighter jock heaven. But even the rare pilot who was aloof from such cheap thrills, such as the Deacon, John Glenn, found plenty of goodies to even out the strain of hard work and mass adoration. Each of them had an eye on Glenn, all right. Glenn's own personal conduct was a constant reminder of what the game was really all about. To all but Scott Carpenter, and perhaps to one other, the way Glenn was going about this thing was irritating. The seven of them were stationed at Langley Air Force Base in the Tidewater section of Virginia on the James River, about 150 miles due south of Washington. Langley had been the experimental facility of the old National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics and was now the headquarters of NASA's Space Task Group for Project Mercury, Every morning, they could count on seeing John Glenn up early, out on the grounds in the middle of everything where nobody could miss him, doing his road work. He'd be out there in full view, on the circular driveway of the bachelor officer quarters, togged out in his sweatsuit, his great freckled face flaming red and shining with sweat, going around and around, running a mile, 2 miles, 3 miles. There was no end to it, in front of everybody. It was irritating because it was so unnecessary. There had been a vague medical directive to the effect that each of them would engage in at least 4 hours of unsupervised exercise per week, but that was the last that was heard of. The medical staff assigned to Project Mercury were mainly young military doctors, a bit dazzled by the mission, some of them, and they were not about to call an astronaut on the carpet and demand an accounting of his 4 hours. Fighter jocks, as a breed, put physical exercise very low on the list of things that made up the right stuff. They enjoyed the rude animal health of youth. They put their bodies through dreadful abuses, often in the form of drinking bouts, followed by lack of sleep and mortal hangovers, and they still performed like champions. I don't advise it, you understand, but it can be done, provided you have the right stuff, you miserable putt-knocker. Most agreed with Wally Schirra, who felt that any form of exercise that wasn't fun, such as water skiing or handball, was bad for your nervous system. But here was Glenn, pounding through everybody's field of vision with his morning road work, as if he were preparing for the championship fight. The good Marine didn't just do his road work and leave it at that either. Oh, no. The rest of them had their families installed at Langley Air Force Base, or at least in the Langley vicinity. Gordon Cooper and Scott Carpenter and their families were packed into apartments on the base, the usual sort of worn-out base housing that junior officers raided. Wally Schirra, Gus Grissom, and Deke Slayton lived in a rather sad-looking housing development on the other side of the Newport News Airport. Around the development was a stucco wall of color known as glum ochre. Alan Shepard and his family lived a little farther away in Virginia Beach, where they happened to be living when he was chosen for Project Mercury. But Glenn has his family housed 120 miles away, in Arlington, Virginia, outside of Washington. And at Langley, he stays in the bachelor officer's quarters, the Bach, and does his running out front in the driveway. If this had been some devilishly clever scheme for him to get away from home and hearth and indulge in drinking and driving and so forth, that would have been one thing. But he wasn't the type. He was living in a bare room with nothing but a narrow bed and an upholstered chair and a little desk and a lamp and a lineup of books on astronomy, physics, and engineering, plus a Bible. On the weekends, he would faithfully make his way home to his wife, Addie, and the children in an ancient Prinz, a real beat-up junker that was about 4 feet long and had perhaps 40 horsepower, the sorriest-looking and most underpowered automobile still legally registered to any fighter pilot in America. A jock with any natural instincts at all, with any true devotion to the holy coordinates, either possessed or was eating his heart out for the sort of car that Alan Shepard had, which was a Corvette, and that Wally Schirra had, which was a Triumph, i.e. a sports car, or some kind of hot car anyway, something that would enable you to hang your hide out over the edge with a little class when you reached the driving juncture on the coordinates several times a week, as was inevitable for everyone but someone like John Glenn. This guy was putting on an incredible show. He was praying in public. He was presenting himself in their very midst as the flying monk, or whatever the Presbyterian version of a monk was, a saint maybe, or an ascetic, or maybe just a village scone crusher. Being a good Presbyterian, John knew that praying in public was no violation of the faith. The faith even encouraged it. It set a salubrious example for the public. Nor did John Glenn feel the slightest discomfort because now, in post-World War II America, virtue was out of style. Sometimes he seemed to enjoy shocking people with his clean living. Even when he was no more than 9 years old, he had been the kind of boy who would halt a football game to read the riot act to some other 9-year-old who said, "God damn it," or "Ah, shit," when a play didn't go right. This was an unusual gesture even where he grew up, which was New Concord, Ohio, but not so extraordinary as it might have been a lot of other places. New Concord was a sort of town, once common in America, whose peculiar origins have tended to disappear in the collective amnesia as tout le monde strives to be urbane, which is to say it began as a religious community. 100 years ago, any man in New Concord with ambitions that reached as high as feed store proprietor or better joined the Presbyterian Church. And some of the awesome voltage of live Presbyterianism still existed when Glenn was growing up in the 1920s and 1930s. His father was a fireman for the B&O Railroad and a good church-going man, and his mother was a hard-working, church-going woman. And Glenn went to Sunday school and church and sat through hundreds of interminable Presbyterian prayers, and the church and the faith and the clean living served him well. There was no contradiction whatsoever between the Presbyterian faith and ambition, even soaring ambition, even ambition grand enough to suit the invisible ego of the fighter jock. A good Presbyterian demonstrated his election by the Lord and the heavenly host through his success in this life. In a way, Presbyterianism was tailor-made for people who intended to make it in this world, as well as on the plains of heaven. Which was a good thing, because John Glenn, with his sunny, round, freckled country boy face, was as ambitious as any pilot who had ever hauled his happy burden of self-esteem up the pyramid. So Glenn went pounding around the driveway of the Bach of Langley Air Force Base in his sweatsuit, doing his road work, and he frankly didn't care if most of the others didn't like it. The running was good for him on several levels. At 37, he was the oldest of the fellows, and there was a little more pressure on him to demonstrate that he was in good condition. Besides that, he had a tendency to put on weight. From the waist up, he was of only average size and musculature, and in fact had surprisingly small hands. But his legs were huge, real kegs, muscular and fleshy at the same time, and he tended to pack on weight in the thighs. He was pushing 185 when he was selected for this thing, and he could well afford to get down to 170 or even less. As for living in the Bach, why not? He and his wife Annie had bought their house in Arlington because the children would be in excellent public schools there. Why transplant them again when he would be on the road half the time and probably wouldn't see them except on weekends anyway? If it looked to the others as if he were living a monastic life, that wouldn't hurt too much. Competition was competition, and there was no use pretending it didn't exist. He already had an advantage over the other six because of his Marine flying record and the way he tended to dominate the publicity. He was ready to give 110% on all fronts. If they wanted 4 hours of unsupervised exercise per week, well, give them 8 or 12. Other people could think what they wanted. He happened to be completely sincere in the way he was going about this thing. The goal in Project Mercury, as in every important new flight project, was to be the pilot assigned to make the first flight. In flight tests, that meant your superiors looked upon you as the man who had the right stuff to challenge the unknowns. In Project Mercury, the first flight would also be the most historic flight. They had been told that the first flight would be suborbital. There might be as many as 10 or 11 suborbital flights, going to an altitude of about 100 miles, 50 miles above the commonly accepted boundary line between Earth's atmosphere and space. These flights would not be going into orbit because the rocket they would be using, the Redstone, could not generate enough power to take a capsule to orbital speed, which would be about 18,000 miles per hour. The capsule would go up and come down in a big arc, like an artillery shells. As it came over the top of the arc, the astronaut would experience about 5 minutes of weightlessness. These suborbital flights were scheduled to begin in mid-1960, and all seven pilots would get a crack at them. Other men would no doubt go farther into space, into Earth orbit, and beyond. But they, in turn, would be chosen from the first men to fly suborbitally. So the first astronaut would be the one the world remembered. When a man realized something like that, there was no use being shy about the opportunity he had. Glenn had not gotten this far in his career by standing still in a saintly fashion and waiting for his halo to be noticed. When he reached Korea, flying strafing and bombing missions in support of Marine ground troops, he realized that the biggest accolade was being assigned to Air Force fighter squadrons on loan, like Shirah, for air-to-air combat up at the Yalu River. So he had gone after that assignment and gotten it, and had shot down 3 MiGs during the last few days of the war. As soon as the war ended, he realized that flight test was the hot new arena and had gone straight to his superiors and asked to be assigned to Navy's Patuxent River Test Pilot School, and they sent him there. He had been in flight test barely 3 years when he dreamed up the F-8U transcontinental run. He dreamed it up himself as a major in the Marines. Although everyone knew it was possible, no one ever made a sustained coast-to-coast flight at an average speed of greater than Mach 1. Glenn developed the whole scheme, the aerial rendezvous with 3 different AJ-1 refueling tankers, the way he would dive down to 22,000 feet to meet them, the whole thing. He pulled it off on July 16, 1957, flying from Los Angeles to Floyd Bennett Field in New York in 3 hours and 23 minutes. The word was there were some test pilots who were put out because he got the assignment. They seemed to think they had done the major test work on the F-8U and so forth and so on. But it was his idea. He got it launched. If he hadn't put himself forward, it wouldn't have happened at all. Last year, 1958, it was obvious to him that all the services were working on the problems of manned spaceflight. There was no Project Mercury yet, and no one knew who would be running the show when a manned program began. All he knew was that it was not likely to be the Marines, but he wanted to play a part in it. So he had himself assigned to the Navy Bureau of Aeronautics. He volunteered for runs on the Navy's human centrifuge machine at Johnsville, Pennsylvania, exploring high G-forces associated with rocket flight. By March of this year, 1959, just a month before the 7 of them were selected as astronauts, he had been at the McDonnell Aircraft Plant in St. Louis as a representative of the Bureau of Aeronautics on a NASA mock-up review board, reviewing progress of the manufacture of the Mercury capsule. He didn't know just how the 7 of them were selected, but obviously all that hadn't hurt his chances. Now the ante had been raised once more, and he was after nothing short of being the first man to go into space. NASA would have to beat the Russians to it, of course, for him or any other American to be first. But that was one of the things that made it exhilarating. Exhilarating enough to endure this sweaty pounding over a salty pine-tag circular driveway in Tidewater, Virginia. There was the same sort of esprit, usually called patriotism, but better described as joie de combat, that had existed during the Second World War and among pilots and practically no one else during the Korean War. Project Mercury was officially a civilian undertaking, but it struck Glenn as being like a new branch of the armed services. All 7 of them were still in the military, drawing military pay even though they wore civilian clothes. There was a warlike urgency and priority about the whole enterprise, and in this new branch of the military, no one outranked you. It was almost too good to be true. On the organization chart, the 7 of them had superiors. They reported to Robert Gilruth, the head of the new Space Task Group, who was a subordinate of Hugh Dryden, the deputy administrator of NASA. Gilruth was a superb engineer and a fine man. He had literally written the book on the handling characteristics of aircraft, the first scientific treatise on the subject, Requirements for Satisfactory Flying Qualities of Airplanes, NACA Report Number 755-1937, which had become a classic. He was a big, bald, shy man with a reedy voice. Most recently, he had been head of the NACA Pilotless Aircraft Research Division, which had experimented with unmanned rockets. Gilruth was not used to marching the troops, and certainly not a group of ambitious pilots. He was no Vince Lombardi. He was a genius among engineers, but he was not the type to take 7 colossal stars, who were suddenly the most famous pilots in America, and mold them into Bob Gilruth's Astro Team. They were so famous, so revered, so lavishly fussed and worried over at all times that they were without peers in this new branch of the military. Everywhere they went in their travels, people stopped what they were doing and gave them a certain look of awe and sympathy. Sympathy, because our rockets all blow up. It was a nice